Care.
Conscious Living, I'm Wendy Garrett. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks. I hope you're having a great day. And thanks for checking stuff out on the web. I've seen some responses there. Yay! Wendy's Coffee House is my blog, and I incorporated that once I started doing some more work. I have done that since I was in radio. And then once I started to get back into more of this stuff, I had been doing a blog at Talking to Nightlights, kind of incorporated some of that, and then the new stuff over for wendyscoffeehouse.com. So if you want to follow along, some of the show stuff for this show will be there too, because I often interview people on the Wendy's Coffee House site that I also either afterwards or before will interview here at Conscious Living. So there's a lot of content there. And if you're interested in anything like this, consciousness, near death, psychics, telepathy, afterlife, UFOs, the whole nine yards, it's all there. So check it out. My guest today, I have talked to him once before. So don't hold it against me if I don't remember everything, because this is a lot of stuff. He's been a psychic for some 40 years, and his name is Gary Wimmer. You can check out his website and find out more, all sorts of stuff about him at garywimmer.com. It's W-I-M-M-E-R. And we're going to talk real quickly about one of the things that kind of launched this whole thing for him. Was a, I don't know how to put it, mind-boggling near-death experience. So with that, without any further ado, hello, Gary. It's nice to talk to you again.
Oh, great, Wendy. Great to hear your beautiful voice.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, this, let's just get right to it. You had a mind-boggling near-death experience. You knew you were psychic as a kid. You knew that that was a part of your reality. So that wasn't the weird thing. The weird thing was how it actually took it to the next level when you got hit by a car. Or is that the way to put it?
Well, that's the best way to put it, yeah.
Okay, well, you can tell a better story than I can. This is amazing how this happened.
Well, it was amazing. I feel like one of the luckiest people on the planet, because I did get to see the other side and experience the infinite mind and God and the infinite universe and so forth, which prior to having experienced that, I didn't know anybody could experience that and come back and be on the planet and talk about it. But I speak at a lot of these near-death conventions now, and more and more people are having this experience, or, of course, no two are alike.
Right.
Every near-death experience is different, just as every person is in every moment in time. But it was certainly a fascinating experience. And if you'd like, I'll give you a little detail about what happened and what I went through.
Yeah, absolutely. And the book, if you're listening, A Second in Eternity tells the story. This, though, when you hear Gary tell it, again, you get a real appreciation for how extreme this might have been. So, yeah, go ahead. Share your story.
Okay, and if you want to ask some questions or have me slow down or anything, let me know. Having lived through this experience and talked about it a lot, I pretty well know the story and can talk for a solid hour about it. So if I get carried away, tell me to take a breath, ask me a question. Okay, Wendy?
Okay, got it.
Okay, as you said, I was very intuitive as a kid. I grew up with two older brothers and four younger brothers. I didn't know what it was until I got in college, and a lady did a horoscope for me and said, "You have a lot of natural psychic ability." Well, I was in college as an electrical engineer, and this is, I don't know, 68 or something like that. And she turned me on to some psychics, and I started reading books about it, and Edgar Cayce especially. In 1977, well, I was a musician my whole life and a psychic. I'm 69. I was born in 47, so my whole adult life has been as a professional musician and a professional psychic. But in 1977, after I quit a band, out of the clear blue one night, toward the end of January in 77, I noticed things started feeling different. I started feeling what people were going to say before they'd say it. I tried to sleep that night, couldn't sleep, woke up the next day, and the first thing I noticed that was rather strange is as my roommate walked into the our little duplex reading a newspaper, I saw the headlines through his eyes, and it really shocked me. And then he threw the paper down on the table, and I realized, wow, it was a headline about Jimmy Carter. And I'd just seen that, and he notices I'm kind of stunned, and, "Are you okay?" I said, yeah. Later that afternoon, I started unpacking a lot of my things. I'd just moved into this house, and every time I'd touch an item, I could feel like I was transported back in time to where the person who'd given me that item was right behind me, and I'd turn around expecting him to see me. I took a walk down to the store, and I realized I'm starting to overhear conversations that people are just thinking about, their thoughts. This started escalating. By the second night, my friend and I, my roommate, he noticed I was starting to pick up some strange things and become preoccupied with things normally that people wouldn't be preoccupied with. I could tell when the phone was going to ring, 5 minutes before it would ring, who would call. And I was in this position where I could, there was no neutral. I was either feeling things overwhelmingly, psychically and spiritually, or I was doing my little test of verification, which I'll explain, but there was no neutral, and I couldn't sleep. I'll give you a couple examples of what happened, and this was about 8 days of this sudden escalation in psychic ability and awareness and spirituality. We went out to a club that night, and it was a little bit bizarre for me in the room with the band. It was just too many people, too much noise. I went and sat in the bar by myself in the front room, feeling rather exhausted from picking up information about everybody. Thought about taking a walk outside, and instantly it feels like I'm standing outside, and I feel two people walk right through me toward the door. And I open my eyes, and I'm still sitting there on the bar stool. The door opened, and the people walked through dressed as exactly the way I'd seen them. And I tried this a couple times, just imagining myself, transporting myself outside to see who was coming in next. And every time it would work correctly. My roommate, who came in from the back room, asked me what was going on, and I, rather than explain to him, I said, I'll bet you $5 I can tell you who's coming through the door next, what they're wearing. And he laughed and chuckled, and I predicted it perfectly. And he said, you were just outside. You, no, ask all these people. I've been sitting here. So I did it another time for him, and he couldn't handle it. He walked off. I couldn't handle it either if someone was telling me that. You know, what the hell's going on, you know?
Yeah.
By the third and fourth day, this had escalated to the point of I had never been so scared in my life. At the same time, I had never felt so empowered and enlightened. I'd never walked on a tightrope so thin, where on one hand I was terrified because I couldn't push the off button. I didn't know why this was happening. I didn't know where it was headed. But I knew by the second and third day, life was not like it was 2 days earlier. I was in a completely different world of consciousness. My roommates, my friends were very concerned. I was, needless to say, acting rather unusual. I'll give you a couple examples that are in the book that I went through. One time my friend and I went to a restaurant, and he was asking me, this is about the third or fourth day, he was asking me if I was still having these profound precognitive urges or seeing what was going to happen next. And I said, absolutely. He said, well, explain it. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. I looked over as far as I could in the restaurant to two ladies sitting in the farthest chair from us. One lady was not even, I just saw the back of her head, and I said, I'm going to have the brunette write me a letter. He said, what? I said, I'm going to have the brunette write a letter to me. A letter about what? I don't care, whatever. So as we ate, he'd forgotten about this, of course, and I kept imagining that lady writing me a letter, very harmless. I even imagined a little path so she could identify me, that she could pick up the guy over here in the blue shirt or whatever, write him a letter.
Mm-hmm.
I kept thinking about that, and then the ladies walked by us, and she threw a napkin down on the table that she had written in big, bold letters. Why are you doing this to me? It gave me chills. I felt like, wow, now I'm starting to interfere with other people's lives. That's not good.
Yeah.
Well, it blew me away. It blew my friend away. I understood it because it was a very simple request. I wasn't sure if it was going to work or not.
Right.
And doing these sort of things was the only thing I could do with this overwhelming psychic ability. As I was saying, I'd either pick it up or I had to, what I call verification. It seemed to be a process. The words seemed to sort of just appear in my head that I've got to constantly verify that I'm still on the planet. I haven't left yet, you know.
Yeah.
So there was all these processes I had to continually do to verify that everything was basically okay. I went through a week of this. Another thing I'll mention in the mentioned in the book, and this is rather bizarre, but at the time it seemed perfectly natural. My roommates and I were talking one night. I was living with two roommates. This is about the second or third or fourth day. I can't remember. We're talking, he was a medic in Vietnam. He was talking about pain people had gone through. And out of the clear blue, I spouted out, well, if people had enough control over their brain chemistry, they could control pain. And he said, you don't know, you haven't seen people getting their guts blown out, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, meanwhile, before this conversation started, we had put on a little saucer pan with water to make some hot tea, hadn't forgotten about it in the middle of this conversation. I looked over at that boiling water, and I heard something in my head said, no, prove it to him, or show him, is actually what it said.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked up this boiling water, and just as casual and confident as I could be, I poured it over my head. And mm-hmm. it scared the hell out of my roommates.
Yes.
The fascinating thing to me is that's the only time in my life I've ever felt water. It felt the same temperature as my body. It was not hot. It was not cold. It was just wet.
There's no disconnect. I mean, there was a disconnect. Yeah.
There was no difference in temperature. It didn't feel hot to me. It didn't feel cold. It just felt wet. My roommates are screaming and hollering. What the hell's the matter with you? You know, one of them dragged me back to the bathroom, made sure I wasn't burned. I wasn't. I didn't feel it. Didn't hurt at all. This went on for a solid week. And it was rather bizarre because by the end of the week, I'd realize I'm starting to influence other people and scare them and make them concerned about me. And so at the end of this week, I decided I just need to walk. I need to get out of the house. And I started walking. I didn't know exactly where I was heading. I just knew I had too much energy to sit in the house and be weird. So I started walking down several blocks, as I start walking, I started feeling things escalate. And I felt these monitors that I had felt for most of this whole week. I didn't see them. I just felt them around me. They seemed like some sort of guardian angels that were protecting me, watching me, monitoring me. Yeah, they seemed to actually name themselves as the monitors. I never had seen them before, but I constantly felt them. They seemed to kind of come in shifts or something. Mm-hmm. So as I'm walking down the street at the eighth day of this escalating psychic ability, I felt them real strong, and I kept feeling these words, keep your eyes on the light. Watch for the signs.
Mm-hmm.
So as I got toward Guadalupe Street in Austin, this had just peaked to the point I was terrified. And I was praying and crying as I was walking down Guadalupe Street. Just people were watching me. They were very concerned. They didn't know what to do. There seemed to be a lot of people on the street that night.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of one of these prayers, I just stopped. I just prayed, God, you got to help me. This is too much. What do you want from me? I don't understand this. I can't push the button off. What the hell's going on?
Yeah. So,
and then I closed my eyes, and I'm doing this little prayer, and I'm praying out loud too because people are watching. You know, I didn't care about being embarrassed. I didn't care what they thought. I was really begging God to make sense of this. It's too much. I can't take it anymore. All of a sudden, I felt this incredible warmth, almost like it had gone from the middle of February in the winter to, you know, hot day in the summer. But it was physical, spiritual, mental, psychological, everything, just immediate warmth. And the intense fear I'd been going through instantly disappeared. I opened my eyes, and I looked up, and there's this huge light about 6 feet over my head. And one of my first thoughts was, wow, if I had a ladder, I could touch it. It's not 4 feet. It's not 10 feet. It's 6 feet, a specific physical distance from me.
Mm-hmm.
And a big, bright light, and I looked around at these people who'd been watching me because I've been, you know, praying and crying, and as I walked down the street, none of them even acknowledged it. And I thought, how can you ignore this? So I looked back up at the light, and it turned out to be a crystal table, a round table about an inch and a half thick. And these white-robed guardian angel-type figures in sort of off-white robes.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't see their faces. They were kind of going from black and white, like a TV or something. They didn't feel feminine, or they didn't feel masculine. They just felt like guardian angels.
Yeah.
And they said, do you trust us? And they spoke in one unified voice. And I said, absolutely. said, I don't understand what's going on. I said, you will. Do you trust us? I said, yes. And, of course, I look around, and these people who had been watching me are looking me talk to an empty sky.
Right, right.
Which added to their, what's going on with this character?
Mm-hmm.
Well, within seconds, I was, and this is in the book, I didn't want to be a spoiler here, I was hit by a speeding car as a pedestrian. And as my head banged into the bumper, the last thing I saw was the headlight. And as my eyes were forced closed by contact, it turned into the Big Bang. I saw the Big Bang, and at that moment, I realized this is just one of Big Bangs. And suddenly, I realized I'm outside my body, looking down at my body, getting banged up by this car.
Mm-hmm.
And within seconds, I was leaving Earth, leaving Austin, and I was expanding in all directions, like a balloon outside, expanding, not like an arrow going in one direction.
Yeah.
And one of the first things I recognized, I saw the whole Earth from 360 degrees, North and South Pole, and every continent and every ocean at one time, because it felt like it was going inside me. Of course, my body's on the floor, on the street, on Guadalupe Street in Austin, Texas. But my consciousness, I suppose, my soul, my psyche was expanding. Planets, galaxies getting smaller and smaller inside me. I kept expanding. By this time, I'd pretty well forgotten about my life, my body being me.
Yeah.
Slowly started disappearing. I crossed what I considered the edge of the universe, and I felt like I'd gone through a level of consciousness called the colors. Again, it seemed to name itself as the colors. It was fascinating. It looked like, you know, the Aurora Borealis.
Mm-hmm.
And what colors seemed to me to be was a level of consciousness that when souls come to the planet, and I realized this because I was expanding out, when souls come to the planet, they collapse inward from all edges of the universe down to the point of birth and pick up parts of all the planets and so forth. Well, I was going in the opposite direction. I was expanding.
Yeah.
So when I crossed the universe, I saw this level of the colors that was a level of consciousness that came to us so we could use our senses and our awareness and our brains to connect back with the infinite universe. Soon I was outside this universe, and I realized it looked like I was looking up at a sky with infinite stars, and I had just come out of one universe, but there's infinite universes. And these infinite universes seemed to turn into a big swirling tunnel of light. And I was going through this tunnel of light. It was the most ecstasy I've ever felt in my life.
Yeah.
Like I said, fear had left me by the time the monitors appeared on Earth just moments earlier. And one interesting thing is that there was no time. I couldn't tell if things were sequential or simultaneous, and it didn't matter. There was no time to, you know, separate things. So I got shot out of this tunnel of light that was the best, most beautiful part of the voyage up so far. And then I felt like I was entering this infinite blue void. It looked sky blue. It was infinite consciousness, infinite love, infinite creativity. And it felt like I was there for eternity. It's almost like it was showing me parts of itself.
Yeah.
All the different creative potential in all the universes. And it also kind of looked like everything was really a product of divine imagination. Physical reality was just a thought, a concept, which seems pretty real to us when we're here. You know?
Yeah, I know. I don't want an encounter with a car the way you had. Nope. Mm-mm.
Oh, it was the most beautiful experience of my life looking back. And like I said, from the time I felt the monitors or saw them this time, in fact, let me backtrack. I looked up and I said, you're the monitors. And they said, yes. I said, wow, I'm so elated that they had revealed themselves. And again, they said, do you trust us? And what they were saying is have no fear about what's about to happen.
Yes. A shorthand.
Absolutely. So anyway, I got shot out of this tunnel of light. I'm in this infinite blue, infinite consciousness. It's the most loving, beautiful, powerful feeling I've ever had. And one thing that fascinated me, and Dr. Eben Alexander, who wrote Proof of Heaven, substantiated this in both his conversations, his lectures, and his book, was all this creativity came from one thing alone, infinite love. Infinite love created everything. And infinite love, infinite mind, infinite creativity, God, whatever, there was two possibilities. Either it existed and everything exists, or it didn't exist and nothing existed. And we know which one exists, infinity. Everything exists. We just have to be caught in one little spot in time and space where we're, you know, can only see what we are allowed to see in this lifetime and within our bodies and our planetary experience and so forth. But I saw everything at once and was completely at awe. And I didn't feel like I was witnessing this or watching it. I just feel like I was back home. I was part of it, but had forgotten it in some way.
Yeah.
Somewhere in this process that seemed to go on for infinity, in eternal time, I felt like I was suddenly observing it instead of being at one with it. And I was drawn back from it, pulled away, pulled back through this tunnel of light, pulled back into a particular universe in this star-studded sky of infinite universes. I was drawn toward one. And in the book, I use the term spiritual gravity because that's what it felt like. I was being pulled somewhere. I didn't know where. I was a little apprehensive because where I had been just a moments ago, if I can cheat and use the word time,
It's our construct.
It felt like I was being pulled somewhere, and I was apprehensive. I didn't know where I was going. Where I just was pretty nice. I doubt it can be that,
Yeah, okay.
So I kept being pulled and pulled and pulled and entered this universe, and the closer I got to this solar system and Earth, the more I felt like I had some connection to this planet. You know, I didn't know who or why or what. But then I got closer to Austin, and I saw my body laying on the street and people screaming and hollering and cars and panicked, and I recognized my body and either dove in or was drawn in, but instantly I'm back in my body. And I opened my eyes, and first thing I remember is this long red hair tickling my face, and it was the hair from the driver who'd run out of his car and just screamed and hollered. He was terrified, you know? He just ran into me.
Yeah.
I'd just been to heaven. I felt great. I jumped to my feet and just started talking to people.
Hallelujah. Oh, yeah. And they're going, what?
I asked them if they'd seen these aliens above me because I didn't know how to describe them otherwise. And people were completely freaked out because from their point of view, what they'd seen is someone crying and praying and scared to death and talking to something that wasn't there and getting hit by a car. And then just immediately getting up and walking around like it didn't even happen. I felt no pain. I wasn't hurt at all. I got one little scratch on my head, but within moments there was, and because nobody was hurt, I felt like just walking home. Right. And all the witnesses said, no, the cops are already coming. The police, you got to stay here. And I thought, if I run, they're going to be chasing me. The cops are going to be chasing me. The ambulance, just stay here.
Yeah, bigger drama.
Yeah, right. Surely I can just explain the situation and go home. Nobody's hurt. good luck.
I was going to say, that's a tall order.
Oh, yeah, because the cops came there in no time and the ambulance. And first thing that kind of stunned them is when the ambulance came, they're looking around for this blood-spattered body. There's nobody on the ground. The car's all torn up. And I raised my hand and said, I'm the one you're looking for. And, of course, everybody points at me. The driver of the ambulance guy came over and said, how the hell are you even standing?
Mind just blown.
Yeah, really. Everybody was mind blown. And I was, too. But I said, I'm standing just like you do, on your feet. And the cop came up and asked me what happened. Well, I started explaining what happened, and that didn't float.
It's like, okay, yeah.
Oh. Just left my body. I went out through this tunnel of light and blah, 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 and
This is going to be a long report.
they were mind blown. And of course, I was even more mind blown, but I felt so good at that time. I didn't care if they believed me or not. I wouldn't have expected them to. I didn't expect anybody to believe me. Well, they had to take me to the hospital. They x-rayed me. They did a bunch of tests on me. The only thing they could do is put a bandage on my head. I had a little scratch. And the car was quite damaged, you know. I didn't feel any pain. I was completely protective. I didn't get hurt. Because I wasn't hurt, they couldn't keep me at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
There was a man who walked into the emergency room. They kind of shoved me over in the corner for a while, and I thought, I wonder what they're going to do with me. So
hang
this
on,
man walked in, and I recognized him because I'd had premonitions.
Gary, just a minute. Take a break. Take a break. We're going to talk about the guy.
And
we're gonna
talk
about it. Yeah, so hang on. Taking a quick break. Gary Wimmer, my guest. Mind blown. Got it? All right, we'll be back talking about more of those aliens. Maybe not aliens. You get the picture. In a few.
Did you know that 7 in 10 girls believe they are not good enough or don't measure up in some way? I'm Amy Poehler. You may know me from film and television, but I'm also involved off-screen, encouraging young girls to be proud of who they are. Body image breakdowns and the pressure to be perfect often causes a girl's self-esteem to plummet. But by being positive role models, we can change that. The number one wish among girls is for their parents to communicate better with them, including more frequent and more open conversations. So get involved and start talking. Begin a conversation with a girl in your life about the importance of self-esteem. Tell her why she is beautiful and set an example by avoiding negative self-talk. You can make a difference in the lives of girls, and that is no laughing matter.
This message was brought to you by American Women in Radio and Television and was made possible through the generous support of the Dove Self-Esteem Fund, working together to raise self-esteem in girls everywhere. To learn more, go to campaignforrealbeauty.com. Thank you for making a difference.
Just now, another kid dropped out of school. There's one every 20 seconds, over 200 kids an hour. That adds up to nearly 5,000 kids every school day. If we do nothing, 3.5 million kids won't receive a diploma over the next 4 years. But there is someone who can change that. And that someone is you. United Way knows that kids who have a caring adult in their life are more likely to make it. So make a pledge. Tutor a child who needs help. Mentor a kid who needs someone on their side. Volunteer to read to children. Because the path to success or failure starts long before graduation day. And the difference between a graduate and a dropout could be you. Take the pledge to volunteer now at unitedway.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
You're so annoying.
You're so annoying.
Stop copying me. Mom, tell her to stop copying me.
Mom, tell her to stop talking me.
Kids will spend 10 minutes copying everything their sibling says.
You're such a doofus.
How about 2 minutes to brush their teeth? Brushing for 2 minutes now can save your child from severe tooth pain later. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. 2 minutes, twice a day. I have the time.
Mom!
A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ad Council.
Hey, Russell Wilson here, and I know how important exercise is.
It's essential.
With Play 60, United Way and the NFL are helping kids stay active and play at least 60 minutes a day.
Healthy kids.
But what this place needs is you. To donate or volunteer, go to unitedway.org/play60 because great things happen when we live united.
Donate.
Are you guys going to do that every time?
Yes, of course.
Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
It's Conscious Living. I'm Wendy Garrett. And you might want to, if you haven't heard the show also on Wendy's Coffee House, I talked with Gary earlier. What happens when you don't enunciate? April 9th, Gary Wimmer. Okay. And that's the one on Wendy's Coffee House. All right. And now we left Gary in the corner. All right. He was at the hospital and they kind of shoved him aside and said, hey, you're not really a priority at the moment. So Gary is hanging out and you saw the guy come in, right?
I saw this man come in and I'd had premonitions about him. In fact, I'd had premonitions about this whole incident during the 8 days. I kept seeing flashes of cops and police and an accident and this man who was walking in the hospital. I couldn't put them together. I didn't know what it meant, but I kept seeing these pictures into the future. So when I'm at the hospital and I'm not hurt and they can't keep me there, this man walks over, and I realized I'd had a premonition about him. I knew his name. He's a psychiatrist. I knew where he went to college and everything. So he comes up to talk to me, and I told him all about himself. And he goes, how do you know this? Have you ever been a patient of mine? And I said, right now, doc, I know everything. I can just tune into anything. And he said, well, like what? And I explained to him that, you know, a weekend or two ago, his wife was gone, and he and his son had changed the furniture around, and she came home and didn't like it, cut out floor space, and his jaw dropped. He said, how do you know that? I said, I can just pick it all up. He said, well, I've heard about this. I've heard about these people who've had these experiences. I've never met one. I said, you have now.
Uh-huh.
So, he said, well, you got to understand, we can't let you just walk out of the hospital. We're going to have to commit you to a psychiatric hospital. I could care less. I was in such bliss. They could put me anywhere. I didn't care. I'd just been to heaven. How can you screw that up? You know?
Like, yeah, I was like, okay, I'm good with that. See ya.
I'm good with whatever. Here's the laws. Here's the regulations. You got to watch people who say crazy stuff, you know, and whatever.
Yeah.
So anyway, I went through that 10-day tour, and at the end of the 10-day tour, I told all the psychiatrists what happened, and it kind of baffled them, and I'm a real friendly guy. I grew up with six brothers. I've certainly never had a lack of personality or being a ham or an entertainer,
especially
a musician. So I had the whole floor. They called me Mr. Smiles. I was helping everybody. I was playing piano for them. I was entertaining them, and I was talking to these girls. There were five or six girls there with teenagers who'd been committed by their parents because they were having sex earlier than their parents thought.
Uh-huh.
How stupid. Commit your kids to a psychiatric hospital rather than just talk to them about sex.
Wow. Yeah, that's frightening.
Oh, it just blew my mind. They're innocent young girls. They, you know, had their first fling or two, and daddy thought they were, mama thought they were screwing up or whatever. So anyway, at the end of the 10 days, you go into all these psychiatrists, and they want to make sure you're okay and balanced before they let you out or decide you need another 10-day mandatory commitment. I told them, I said, look, you guys may not believe this story. I don't care. If you want to keep me in here for another 10 days, I'll entertain your patients. I'll make everybody happy. But I ain't changing the story to get out.
Yeah,
here's
right.
What happened.
It's what
And they agreed that, you know, I'm a fairly intelligent guy. I had great recommendations from all the nurses and patients on the floor. They all liked him.
Keep him. We love him.
Oh, that was, and I, like I said, I enjoyed entertaining people. So that's kind of the story in a nutshell. And then over the next, you know, it took me several months to kind of, for the constant intuitive psychic power to get back to a manageable level.
Yeah.
I'm not near as psychic as I was during that 1 week, but I don't want to be. It was uncontrollable.
Man. Yeah.
I do psychic readings now, but I can tune into it at will and without it being so so bizarre, you know. So, but it changed my life. I realized how beautiful it is when we pass over. And as I told you, I lost a brother just a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was an emotional challenge and a challenge for me and my family. But I know what peace people have after this life. Our challenge is here, now, not out there. We have no control of what goes on out there other than what we do here. And if we do the best we can here and try to grow and evolve, that side's covered. If we're complete creeps, like, you know, Hitler or something like that, I'm sure he has to go through his
10-day program.
Yeah, he has to relearn to undo all that. Hell, he might have been born 10,000 times and being abused like he abused the Jews. Who knows?
Yeah.
But it was certainly the most beautiful experience in my life, and I have no fear of death. And I suggest everybody, don't fear death. It's beautiful. It's liberation. There's no big judgment where you're going to go through heaven or hell. There's a chance for you to view your own life so you can make your own decisions about how to come back and correct things. And the irony of the whole life and existence is it's all one big dream in the mind of infinite God. But to us personally, it's a very personal, separate, individual experience in time and space. And they're both true. It
I want to ask
individual experience.
Two things.
Go ahead, Cindy.
The first thing, you mentioned the life review. Did you have one? Second thing, did you have more contact with the monitors and
I did, actually, and I'll explain to you how. Once I had this incident and, got out of the psych, well, actually, from the moment I had this incident, standing in the street, completely blown away by what I just experienced, the one question I could not figure out is, why did I get this experience?
Yeah.
Why was I so lucky? You know, it's the most beautiful experience I've ever had in my life. And there can't be a more beautiful experience. But what did I possibly do to deserve this? And 7 or 8 months later, I got my answer. The monitors appeared again. I didn't see them. I could feel them. And they almost felt like they put a laser in my third eye. They projected this thought, this awareness, this answer. And instantaneously, it seemed like they were both saying it in their one voice, and it was rolling in my eyes like movie credits. It was amazing. And basically, to sum it up, it was a short conversation that said, the reason you had this experience is because you were curious. You always wanted to know. You asked the questions. You could handle it. You were prepared for this. Mm-hmm. And that's why you had the experience, because you wanted to know, and you worked at it, and you asked, and you could handle it. And then they kind of disappeared, as if to say, our job with you is through. I hope you enjoyed the ride. All I can say is, damn right, how can I get another ticket? You know?
Oh, yeah.
Can I give away tickets? You know? I wish I could give everybody a ride there. There'd be perfect peace and love on this planet if I could. You just cannot come back the same way.
Well, and that's, I think, the importance that people are understanding about some of the near-death experiences. As you say, they're all different. And I've had my own experience. It didn't involve dying, but it did involve contact in different forms with different beings in different states of awareness, and one where everything just melted and I felt like I was, one with everything and anything. And it was given to me during a guided presentation with my aunt, where we were doing hypnosis to put me down so I could do channeling. And they were teaching me, these guides were teaching me how it worked and how to disconnect. And they said, we're going to count to two. And I'm like, yeah, right. Well, this is an interesting thing, because my aunt is sitting across from me. I'm channeling them, counting me down to two. Okay. So it's being in multiple, it's hard to explain, but that's the way it worked. And so as my aunt says one, I am gone. I am gone from being in my body to just, wow. And in that moment, I have all this incredible awareness. It's like, all I can say is, you felt like butter, like just melting in this warmth, bliss, state of no time, of no being, of just is. And then she said two. And within that split second, I knew if I did not come back, I wouldn't, because there's, this shift of, I had to make a choice. And that point, I knew I needed to snap back. And it was like, oh my gosh. But I never in my own way of thinking logically and with everything, dots connecting, linear mind, I would never have thought I could have something like that projected at me from some discarnate other form of consciousness to tell me what would happen, and then have my mind shifted in that instantaneous one. Like, wow. Oh,
isn't it beautiful?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But, that's the stuff that we, when we experience that, it makes it hard to go to work.
I know. It makes the normal, mundane things in life seem less significant, but in the same vein, that's what we're going through. That's what we're learning. That's the stage upon which we're evolving.
Well, the thing, too, though, is it makes everything more special.
Absolutely.
You see things and you think that everything has its own special reason for being. And even if it's a negative thing, it has a purpose. There's a point. There's somebody else who needs that impact, and that's the way they're going to get it. So you become much more more concerned about your own thing and less concerned about trying to judge and figure everything else out, because there are definitions and meanings beyond anything we have here or the ability to fathom. So when, hearing your story, I love it, because it's so real. It's so I believe the reason there were so many people around and the reason you had to go through the proper steps to be certified, you know, bona fide.
Right.
So people had witnesses so that they could say, well, we know this guy. We've seen this guy. This is real. If you had just vanished and, you know, evaporated from that scene, it wouldn't have had the footprint and it wouldn't have had the strings and the connections to other people, the psychiatrist you talked to, you know, all of those people going, oh, because they have to go back and figure out how that fits in all of their terminology and how to work with their patients. And they've got a clue here that maybe it doesn't work the way they think it does. And you are it. You are that one instance where things aren't what they seem. And that's what I love about your story.
Oh, I was supposed to tell everybody. Like you said, if I would have gone away, I wouldn't have been able to tell anybody. And I had to tell everybody, the cops, the police, the psychiatrist, my everybody wanted what happened. I had, a 1-minute version, a 3-minute version, a 5-minute version. How much detail do you want? You know?
Well, and I'm thinking of the guy who had to put that insurance report, you know, in. Okay, I got a claim. Well, where did you hit a guy? And the guy's, he's fine. You go talk to him. And like, wait a second. They have to figure out what happened. Where's the blood? Where's the proof? Are you sure? You know, is this a false report? I'm just thinking the poor guy who had to file the insurance on his vehicle, you know, when they're looking at that going,
And okay. Also in my book, A Second in Eternity, I put the paperwork in I still had and got the police records from 1977. I got them about 5 years ago when I started writing the book. So the police records are in there, the letter from the doctor, the commitment papers. It's all the paperwork I had, but it's the best way I could substantiate that I'm not making this up. Because the police report, it's kind of clumsy, but they say something about the UFO lunacy.
See, that's when you said aliens. That's the thing. When I woke up one night, it was like 1992 or 94, and I woke up in the middle of the night, and I was hearing people talk in the bedroom, and my husband, he's sound asleep, doesn't hear it. I don't know where the cat was at the time, but I saw these two tall beings at the end of the bed. They had a clipboard, kind of a clipboard, and they were in white robes. I couldn't see faces. It was dark, and it was just, you know, instantaneous. I see them there, and they're writing about me, and I heard one say, "She's awake," and they vanished. I'm like, "Dang it! Dang it! That is so not fair! What were you writing? You know, so it's like, but so those moments of having, what do you call them? Because there's people, oh, they're the tall whites, so the great whites, not sharks, but they're these ethereal beings. They're angels. They're we don't know what this is. In my opinion, we have names and we have categories and we're trying to connect dots, but we're not there yet. We're not there yet, in my opinion.
Yeah, we're always learning about that. Two things I wanted to mention here that I'd suggest that your listeners do is, first of all, realize that you can learn to read the signs in life. That's what I went through for a solid week of being able to pick up things. We can learn that. It was just kind of dumped on me all of a sudden before I even thought about reading the signs, looking at the external world and connecting that with the internal dots, and realize you can learn a lot by just observing yourself and observing the world, observing the signs, the way things fold, action, response. You can learn a lot about your intuitive ability, but you have to work on it. Just like typing or driving or making pasta, you know, practice makes perfect. And also guardian angels. We have more guardian angels than we ever imagine. There are more souls and more entities and higher consciousness so willing and so ready and able to help us grow. But the irony is you have to ask, because if you don't ask the universe to empower you and show you the light and so forth, it's being forced on you. And if it's forced on you, it's not by your choice and your free will. So you have to ask the universe. And the more you ask, the more times you ask the universe to help your God or your guardian angels, however you look at it, the more you're giving explicit permission for them to help. And that's a very critical issue because, you know, we all get a little bit of help from our guides and our guardian angels. But it's within the bounds of acceptability by the rules, I suppose you could say.
Yeah.
But if you want more, you have to give your permission. Yes, help me. Show me. Not only give me some answers, but show me how to interpret the signs. Show me how you're giving me the answers, you know. Praying is very good, but so is meditating and learning to get the answers, because you can pray all night and day, and you're not going to get a sheet of paper floating down from heaven with instructions, you know.
Well, maybe.
Maybe, but most of the time it's through feelings and thoughts.
Okay, so then what do I assume in terms of, like, if I look at the headlines, can I see my signs in the headlines? Can I look, you know, how do you work with your signs?
I'm not overwhelmed or drive myself crazy by trying to look at them all the time. I did then because I had no choice. It was just overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I can live a very normal life and pick up information on a need-to-know basis without driving myself crazy constantly asking. It's just basically being aware. And this happened 40 years ago in April, actually February 7th, 1977. So it was 40 years and a couple months ago. That's a lot of time to practice.
Yeah.
I didn't even think about reading the signs or connecting to the universe in such a level before that. But since that, I realize it's very possible. So, yeah, I set myself up to, it's almost like, okay, universe, when I need to do something, grab my attention, so I don't have to constantly walk around asking for it. It's sort of second nature now.
Mm-hmm.
It started by me asking the universe way back then, why did this happen to me? What did I do to possibly deserve this? It's the most beautiful gift any human being could ever get. Why me? You know? And the answer, of course, well, you wanted to know. Ask and you shall receive. Maybe not Tuesday at noon, but you'll either get it or something that's equivalent that'll show you why you didn't get it or why you don't need it or whatever. But we don't get everything we want. But if we ask the universe to empower us and show us the signs, we'll get a lot more than if we never even think about that.
My question,
the universe doesn't want to force us to evolve or grow or learn. It's in no rush. We can spend a million lifetimes learning to, you know, recite the alphabet. Or we can learn it in one lifetime by paying attention and listening to your teacher. And our teacher is life, our consciousness. One thing I wanted to mention, Wendy.
Yeah.
I was listening to your commercials, and one of them said something about women's lack of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
Most of my clients are female, because you ladies are so much more complex than men. You just are.
One way to put it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you really are. And I think you women forget that men don't calculate things the same way. We have different brains and different sexual functions and different bodies and everything. And I want to suggest to all your female listeners, don't judge yourself on your value of your love by whether Joe gets it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Joe can't get it the same way you do. Love yourselves for how much love you put out, because you ladies do. You really do. You bend over backwards in love and relationships, and you get frustrated if Joe doesn't get it. Don't put your satisfaction and your value of love on the goalpost that you have no control over. Joe's getting it. Put it on your own. I put it out. I did my best. I loved. I bent over backwards. If he didn't get it, that's his problem. And move on and feel your empowerment. So I see this female lack of confidence, and it really kind of hurts, because you ladies make the world work. You know?
So, there's a lot of that going around right now. It's a theme. Part of it, though, is that I believe that's why each person has their own choice of whether, you know, the female or male masculinity, whatever they've chosen to incarnate into this time, gives them the benefit. Whether if they've been a male before or a female before this time, it's like, okay, maybe I can feel it differently and more efficiently this time in this body, in this go-round.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you ladies that are listening in, love yourselves and pat yourself on the back for the love you put out, rather than judge yourself if Joe gets it or not.
My question is a little bit more esoteric. I want to know if you have an effect of electricity, if you feel electricity, if you hear electricity, if you sense it.
You mean like electric current is generated?
Yes.
Or
yes, electricity, the real because I know with some of the NDE and expanded consciousness experiences, there's this connection that is electric. I mean, I've got it with my nightlights.
I've never thought about it in those terms, to be honest with you, but I'm a musician and I was an electrical engineer, and I've always tinkered with electronics and musical gear and recording studios and stuff like that. So I probably have experienced it, but just never thought about it in those terms.
That's my, you talked about your background. I was thinking, oh my, there you go. The lightning bolt, literally.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned that. I graduated in college in 1970 with an electrical engineering degree, and it was all defense work, and I was a war protester, and so I ended up playing music, which certainly didn't make me very rich or famous, but I never got in traffic. Worked my own hours, self-employed my whole life, playing music and being a psychic, and so I've got no complaints at all about life or what I deal with or whatever. I feel like the most fortunate person on the planet for just having seen that, you know, there's light at the end of the tunnel. And if you don't feel it now, you can learn to feel it now.
What's the name of your band?
I've played solo for about the last 30 years.
Okay.
And I want to give you folks a real quick idea about decision-making. I used to be quite depressed in my 20s because as a musician, one thing I realized when I first started playing in the early 60s and through high school bands and college bands, that I'm a crappy singer. I don't have a good voice.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And in the early 70s, that drove me nuts because I couldn't get in the bands I wanted. In 1980, I made the decision, I was off the road, to learn to play the piano. And I spent 3 years, 12 hours a day practicing. I went out to some piano bars in the mid-80s, 83, 84, and they hired me, to my surprise. And I just vowed to myself, well, I don't play like these other guys do, and I don't sing like these guys do. I'm a crappy singer and a crappy player, so how am I going to keep this gig? And I decided I'm going to be a good entertainer. I even wrote songs like, what the hell am I doing here? Start to type, you know. I'd make fun of myself. I'd get people to laugh. I became a very good entertainer because I'm a crappy singer and not that great of a player. But by the mid-80s, I was a full-time solo artist. I got more money. I got more gigs. I didn't have to coordinate with six people. So from the mid-80s on, I played solo. Moral of the story is this. When you set your mind on what you can do instead of what you can't do, I can pray all day and I'm not going to sing like Ray Charles. Ain't going to happen, you know. And if I did have the voice, I'd get everybody to back me up. But when you do practice on what you can do, I can learn to play the notes. I learned that on guitar. Listen, duplicate. Did the same thing on the piano. Didn't take lessons. Just bought a bunch of piano records and listened to them and listened to the right hand, the left hand, and started practicing. When you practice and work on what you can do, you'll probably not only achieve what you want or working toward, but you're going to get a lot more. You're going to find new things that you never even thought about. I didn't start playing the piano to be a soloist. I did so I'd have two instruments. It turned out to be very good because I became a solo player and traveled all over, lived in Europe all during the 90s and traveled all over and got better money. Make a decision to empower yourself, practice, and you'll be surprised what you'll come up with. That's the power of decision making and follow through. If it worked on me, a crappy singer, it can work with everybody.
I can understand that. I had a very traumatic experience singing as a kid, and it kind of shocked me. I guess straight.
All in life was a great voice. I was interested in music from a little kid. I always wanted to have that great voice. Never had it, but I did figure out a relative path to satisfaction is accepting my shortcomings in my voice and bringing up my strengths, which is being a good entertainer, laughing at myself, not taking myself so damn serious, you know?
See, we didn't even get into the work that you do with lithomancy. And how do you, that's, you know, working with stones and the way that you tell you're going to have to come back, Gary. I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to take time.
Real quickly, if your listeners are interested in that, they can go to either my website or lithomancy.com, LITHO. MANCY.com. In 1980, I met a lady who taught me this method of reading stones. I'd never seen it before. In 2000, I came back from Europe. I didn't have internet access because I was traveling all over, and checked out the internet to see how other people did lithomancy, and there was nothing written on it. So I wrote, as far as I know, the only comprehensive book about how to read stones.
Okay, Gary, Gary, we're going to have to leave him with that little carrot, okay?
Okay, my dear. Again, a pleasure being with you. God bless you, Wendy. Love your energy.
Thank you. Thank you. We're going to talk again. So if you're listening, Gary's going to come back, okay? We're going to talk more about the stones and how he does that next time. Because you heard him say that he would do that, right? I heard him say that. I know he's thinking that. And we all want it, okay? So, hey, thank you for listening. Check out wendyscoffeehouse.com and check out garywimmer.com, the site. All right? Till next time, think those good thoughts. You're doing the world a favor and yourself. See ya.